This is The Reason Interview, where we go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, politicians, and visionaries who are making the 21st century more libertarian, or at least more interesting, by challenging worn-out ideas and orthodoxies. I'm Billy Binion, guest hosting for Nick Gillespie. Our guest this week is Jeff Asher, a nationally recognized crime data analyst and former CIA employee who now leads the firm AH Datalytics. Asher, who also publishes the Substack Jeffalytics, has made a name for himself documenting crime trends city to city across the country. During our conversation, we discussed the substantial crime decline we've seen over the last couple of years, what people and the media get wrong about the crime debate, and potential reasons why 2025 may have just seen the lowest murder rate ever recorded. And now, The Reason Interview with Jeff Asher. Jeff Asher, thank you for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
So you are one of the more meticulous crime analysts out there right now. You know, I've used your data many a time. You document crime trends city to city. And so I want to start kind of broad and ask, what do you think people most get wrong about crime, especially when considering that the subject, you know, it attracts a lot of public attention?
So I think two things. One is that we've sort of created a feedback loop, typically, where either crime is rising or the data is wrong. So I think that typically it creates a lack of willingness or a desire, or I don't know, desire is probably too strong of a word, but just a general sense that crime is usually going up and things are usually getting worse. And sometimes that's true. And I'm the first one to talk about it when it is, but frequently it's not true, especially over the last 25 years. And so that's one thing that I think people tend to get wrong. And the other is that inherently the answer is inherently coming from a law enforcement, policing, criminal justice standpoint. And I think that what we're seeing, and I'm not approaching this as someone that's saying that law enforcement's doing nothing or that there's no involvement in law enforcement when we sometimes see, or the criminal justice system, when we see crime go down. But frequently, I think what we're seeing, especially now, is these sort of big national trends that appear to be driven more by societal changes and big picture changes rather than, hey, we did this program in our city and that's driving it down. And so I'm just thinking, I'm not going to call out the city, but murder fell in this city in 2025, just like it's pretty much fallen everywhere. And the newspaper headline was, is it the mayor or the district attorney that's responsible? And there's no like, or it could be this third thing that is right, probably the same thing that's driving it down elsewhere.
So let's start with the good news that you just mentioned. What are we seeing in terms of crime rates right now?
We're seeing the largest one-year drop in murder for the third straight year. In 2025, we're seeing the murder rate at the lowest level that we've ever recorded it. And
when did we start recording?
We started recording really in the 1960s.
Okay.
You can go back farther, but the farther you go back, the less apples to apples you get. So the FBI didn't really start doing national estimates until 1960. They did some estimates in the 1950s and 1940s and really going back to 1930, but they did it from smaller and smaller samples of the population. And so we can kind of get some guesstimates of what the national murder picture looked like in the 1940s and the 1950s and 1930s, but it's with a lot less clarity and certainty. And so I would say back to 1960. You can also do homicide back to 1900. But the farther back you go, the less and less full data you get. So if you go back before 1930, you get fewer and fewer states from which to draw the national homicide rate from. So kind of 1960s where I'm comfortable with.
Okay. And then when did this historic decline begin? You said the last year it's the, you know, largest drop that we've seen on record. Did it start in 2025, or has this been a trend that has been encouraging for a while?
It started in 2023. I remember I got a ton of press in June or July of 2023 when I published a piece for The Atlantic that said the murder rate is suddenly plunging. And so we had the largest one-year drop ever recorded in 2023, which was at the time around an 11 or 12% decline. In 2024, the FBI reported a nearly 15% drop in last year. So that was last year, the is formally the largest one-year drop that's ever been recorded. And we don't have and won't have sort of national estimates for a number of months. So probably August, September of 2026 is when we'll get 2025 official data. But we can use sampling of cities and basically see murders down a lot. And it's down in our sample of 550 or so agencies, it's down around 20%, almost 20%. So that is a really good predictor of what the national trend will be. And that points to probably somewhere in the 18 to 20% range in 2025, which will supplant 2024, which supplanted 2023 as the largest one-year drops ever recorded.
So I want to talk about a specific city, and it's the city that I am in, so I'm a little biased. But Washington, D.C. has gotten a lot of attention for allegedly massaging, I will say. I guess that's a nice way to say it. But the police department is accused of, you know, people manipulating the crime data to make it appear less dire than it is, and there's an investigation into that. And so when I've covered this issue for a while, and I, you know, the response I often get is that when, you know, we're observing these crime declines, that it must be that we just don't have all the data, that police departments are lying, or that people aren't reporting crimes. How do you respond to that?
Yes, I think is the answer. DC is really complicated. And I know you said we only have an hour, so we're, you know, we could do several hours on that. The issues are manifold. One, yes, crime is underreported. Especially, this is especially problematic with certain types of crime. Most property crime, except for auto theft and things like rape and sexual assault, that we know are just systemically underreported. Mm-hmm. Something like a third of property crimes and about half of violent crimes other than murder. We know murder, we feel good about murder. Not as a crime, but as a, this is getting reported, we feel good that it, the numbers are accurate.
Right.
So the challenge is, this is a systemic problem. We know it exists. But how can we, basically, is the problem getting worse? And there's not really evidence over the last 10 years or so that underreporting itself is getting worse. So therefore, the numbers that we're getting tend to be, we're not expecting them to be more underreported than ever before. That's sort of the big picture look at national underreporting. So we know this is a problem. It's not a problem with murder. It's not a problem with auto theft. It generally is a problem of varying scale. In DC, we can look at the data that the city is producing, and we can compare that to the data that they're telling the FBI, that they're sending to the FBI. And the challenge is that this, the DC Police Department is not reporting at the exact standard when it's doing its public data reporting. It's reporting slightly differently to what they're reporting to the FBI, which is kind of the grand number. So they report assault with a deadly weapon, not aggravated assault. That's slightly different. They report, I think, sex abuse, not rape. That's right. Slightly different. So the numbers that we see to the FBI are not quite what we expect when we see what's reported on the city's publicly available data portal. It suggests strongly that the publicly reported data portal is not particularly accurate, especially when it comes to aggravated assault or to assault with a deadly weapon, to robbery, and to sex abuse. So DC's publicly available violent crime data is not reliable. We should not use that. We can compare that with the data that's available to the FBI and say, oh, the data to the FBI looks pretty good. If they're trying to underreport data to the FBI, they're failing because they actually reported in 2024 an increase in aggravated assaults to the FBI. So it looks like what's happening is that whatever they're doing publicly is not great, but that what's happening, the data gets to the agency writes it down with reasonable accuracy, and it gets it to the FBI with reasonable accuracy. So we can see the district's crime trends using other sources. We can use the gun violence archive. We can use the DC's murder data, which appears to be accurate. And we can use the DC health department data. And we can combine these different sources and say, okay, the data looks accurate. And we can say that crime is falling in DC without touching DC's publicly available data set, or without relying on the publicly available data set to evaluate the city's violent crime, because the property crime data looks okay and the murder data looks okay. So that gives us a decently strong assessment of the district's crime trends, while also acknowledging that, hey, the publicly available data on the district's data feed is not particularly good. And that brings us to the investigations that are happening. The House Oversight Committee is investigating, and the Department of Justice is investigated. And I don't know if you've seen the results of those investigations, but at least at this point, they show the same thing, that there's some quirkiness in the data. Nobody liked the police chief. The police chief appears to have set up an environment that was not conducive to accurate data reporting, but it also doesn't specifically show, hey, the data is being manipulated. These alternate sources are not reliable. There's no evidence of some grand conspiracy to tank DC's crime trends to show that the trends that we have from the data are not accurate. And so that's, I think, where we get is that, yeah, crime data is flawed. DC's crime data is flawed. There's no reason to suspect that the overarching trends that we're seeing are not accurate.
To your point about property crime being consistently bad across cities, when I lived in Dallas, I reported my car was broken into. I reported it to the police department, and they just sent me a little postcard that was like, sorry, we can't do anything about this. Good luck. Best of luck to you. And I was like, okay. I understand that it's not the most important crime to solve, but I was like, oh.
I'll do a complete tangent here, but I lived in Dallas too for a couple of months. I was living with a buddy, and our house got broken into, and they like kicked in the door. They stole the television. They stole my laptop. And I had my Texas, Oklahoma tickets that were sitting on the nightstand. And it was like the next week was number one Texas versus number four Texas versus number one Oklahoma. And they left the tickets there. And I was like, you know what? Don't care. I'm not going to worry about any of this. They left my tickets. And I went to Texas and got to see UT beat number one OU in 2008. So
the guy who broke it, or the maybe a woman who broke into my car, left his cigarettes. And I don't even smoke, so I didn't even get anything out of it. I have never smoked a cigarette, but you know, I should have pawned them off on a friend. So you are saying, in general, is it pretty hard to like manipulate? So we're talking about other, you know, property crime, whatever, but which I don't mean to be glib about, but in terms of murder specifically, it is pretty hard to hide a body, right? In terms of manipulating that data and making murder specifically look less dire than it is, right?
Yeah, it's entirely, it's very difficult to hide a body. And I think that the assumption is that our murder data is good. In general, where we track shootings, we feel decently confident that the number of shootings is accurate. And so that's why I feel pretty good about the assessments of murder. It's not something, it's something that we can also compare the murder data with the gun violence archive, which has shooting data. And then we can combine that with the CDC data, which is not relying on police departments, but is relying on coroner reports, and their homicide numbers. And so we can track all those three. And if those look different, then we feel kind of weird. But in general, the trends there are identical.
One thing that I think is very interesting about this conversation is the debate around how these numbers are influenced by advances in trauma care. and life-saving interventions. And, you know, sometimes people will respond like, well, what about the attempted murder rate? What do you think about that?
You've given me the perfect plug for my newsletter, which Jeffalytics at Substack.com or not Substack.com, because I have actually writing about this for next week. I was just finishing up what next week's subject matter will be. But it's this exact point, which is that we can measure this, and I get this a lot, and I don't want to discount the fact that emergency trauma care has succeeded in improving substantially. And there is evidence that better trauma care saves lives. The problem is that we're basically at a point over the last 10, 15, 20 years, to say nothing over the last 40 years or 60 years, the availability of sort of high-powered firearms, assault rifles, larger caliber firearms and ammunition, has basically almost certainly led to the improvements of trauma care being sort of washed away by shootings. Are the individual firearm is more fatal than it was 10, 15, 25 years ago. And so we see this in data in lots of places where we get shooting data. So like New York City, or Chicago, or New Orleans, or Cincinnati, places where we're able to track 15, 20, 25 years, even in almost 30 years of shootings in New York City. And we see that the share of shootings that are fatal in most of these places has either stayed steady or even gone up. So like, New York City, the share of shootings in 2011 that were fatal was 19%. So 19% of people that were shot in New York City from a criminal standpoint, so not including accidental shootings or suicides, 19% of those of criminal shootings were fatal. Last year in 2025, it was 21%. Chicago, it's gone up from 13% to 19%. In New Orleans, where I am, in 2010, it was 32%. Last year, it was 29%. It's generally hovered at that 30-ish percent range. So we see basically the share of these shootings that are fatal has not really changed. And in New York, going back to the 90s, murder fell 89%, I think, last year compared to the 90s, which is amazing. And shooting victims were down about 90%. So we basically don't see any change in what you might call the lethality of shootings. And I think that that's a factor of trauma care has gotten better, and it's balanced by the fact that the number of shootings being carried out with smaller pistols is much lower now than it was, is much lower now than it was 20, 25 years ago.
So you analyze a bunch of different cities, and people can go to your Substack and find the data, which is excellent. But since there are so many to choose from, I'm wondering if there's one city that you're like, wow, this is really surprising, or this was kind of a gold standard for, they're doing something right. I mean, was there, when you're looking city to city, is there one where you're like, wow, that's really interesting that crime plunged in X?
That's a good question. I think that the answer is probably no, because you're seeing it everywhere. And DC kind of stood out in 2023. If you recall, it had an enormous increase in murder. It had a big increase in carjackings and robberies. And that was the outlier. And so right now, when you're seeing huge declines, New Orleans, where I am, had 70-something percent drop in murder from 2022 to 2025. Enormous drops in carjackings, enormous drops in everything, but it just comes on the tail end of an enormous increase where New Orleans had doubled its murder count from 2019 to 2022. So we're not seeing standout cities in that you want to point to one place, you're seeing dozens of standout cities. And so at this point, the outliers are the places that aren't seeing large declines, that aren't below where they were in 2020. The outliers are not the place. I think DC still is above where it was a few years ago. It's seen very large declines. There are undoubtedly places that are seeing increases this year, because when you see 80% of cities having a decline, you're going to have 20% of cities that are seeing an increase. Milwaukee last year, I think, had a slight increase in murder, despite the fact that it's had reasonably large declines pretty much every other year. Hampton, Virginia went from 13 murders to 24. Fayetteville, North Carolina went from 21 to 30. It's much easier to point those cities out than the long list of cities that had just enormous declines last year.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned just then, you know, I used to live in Norfolk, so I'm familiar with Hampton, which is right across the water. And I think you said it was Fayetteville, North Carolina. These are smaller cities that don't, you know, dominate the national discussion. I feel like the national discussion is almost entirely based around, you know, individual crimes that kind of grab headlines in New York City and DC and Los Angeles, that sort of thing. I mean, what do you make of that about how the smaller places kind of go under the radar? Should we be giving them more attention?
I think we absolutely should. And there's a bunch of places. I had a piece a couple of weeks ago that looked at 12 cities that had the lowest murder count and rate for any year that they've had since the 1960s. And so there were 12 of them that I found, and a number of them that are sort of that in that smaller, they're still larger cities, but are smaller, that really stood out. And places like Providence, Rhode Island had the fewest murders since 1962. Richmond, California in 91 had 61 murders, and they had 5 last year. Bridgeport, Connecticut had 60 murders in 92, and they had, I think, either 2 or 4 last year. So a bunch of places. Yeah, you've got Philadelphia, you've got Chicago. San Francisco had the fewest murders since 1942. But there are a lot of smaller places that had this horrific stretch in the 90s and are now seeing virtually the elimination of gun violence in 2025. It's a fantastic story.
So, you know, of course, in 2020 and 2021, you know, especially with COVID, we saw this murder increase that I think in some sense felt a little apocalyptic because it was so dire and it's scary in a lot of ways. I think a lot of people hear the news that you're describing and think like, oh, well, of course, we're seeing a decline because we were coming off of an enormous what felt like an apex. It's not just though that it was high and has come down from a high. It is low by any standard, correct? How do you respond to that objection?
I mean, we likely had the lowest murder rate that we've ever recorded. I would challenge a single person in 2020, 2021, or 2022 to produce evidence that they predicted anything like this. You look at the 90s and the 80s, where we had this enormous increase in murder. We had a murder rate that was 2.5 times what it was last year and nationally. And it just sort of stayed there. And then all of a sudden in the mid 90s, after years and years of horror, it came down. And it came down for 5 or 6 years. And then it just sort of stayed there for most of the last 15, 20 years. So none of this, I think, is predictable. It's easy in hindsight. Who's at South Park that has the hindsight man, the superhero who goes around and telling people like...
You're talking to a widely libertarian audience, so I'm sure they will appreciate a South Park reference.
Unfortunately, I haven't watched it in quite a while, but that sticks out is like nobody saw this coming in hindsight. And I don't think that there's anything obvious about it, because I hate when we say that, oh, this was going to happen, because it implies that there was nothing done that caused it. And I think that there were causes. It wasn't just, you know, COVID happened and then COVID stopped.
Right.
And let's so
that is a good segue.
Oh God, I hate this. No.
Do you? Oh no. Well, I'm going to ask anyway.
Well,
So I actually want to start with the 90s because, you know, you describe kind of like a relentless bloodshed in the night. And people, I mean, talk about it all the time. A lot of people will say, you know, well, it's like the standard of comparison in the worst way, you know, like at least we're not in the 90s kind of thing. So what happened in the 90s?
So I keep pitching my Substack. I spent a year watching Saturday Night Live because I don't know, I get like 20 minutes away when the kids are in bed, my wife's getting ready for bed. And, you know, I throw on my pajamas and brush my teeth and get in bed. And I watch, so I watch like 20 minutes of Saturday Night Live. And this segue has a point. And so I wrote a Substack where like one of the very few I do that wasn't about crime. It's just like, I took data. I found somebody that ranked every episode, every host, every sketch. And so I did like, here's the data of Saturday Night Live for 50 years. And I started it with my three favorite crime jokes. One of them was John Belushi, his brother, Jim Belushi, who was being interviewed. They said like, the lead in is somebody is mugged on the streets of New York every 11 seconds. And we're here to interview him. And it's Jim Belushi. And he keeps getting robbed every 11 seconds. But my favorite joke was Norm Macdonald, who was the best, Weekend Update host there was. And he says, and I can't do justice to Norm Macdonald, but the joke is that, New York Police Department is reporting a 20% drop in crime. There have only been 374 murders. Only 374 murders, if you ask me, that's 314 too many. And then he does his like stare. And it's an amazing joke. But I was thinking about this, and this was in 95, I think, May of 95. And it's 314 murders in May of 95. 374 murders in May of 95, which is a 20% drop and is way more than the city had in all of 2025. You look at the data for New York City, they had something like a 87% drop in murder victims from the mid 90s, the early 90s. Through last year. They had over 2,000 murder victims in 1990. They had just barely 300 last year. So the progress that has been made in a lot of places is just astounding. And whenever I'm asked, and the reason I don't like is because I like to deal in certainty and I don't like to deal in hypothetical. And I always lead with, we don't really know why it fell in the 90s. We have ideas. We have some tested, and like each analyst has their preferences, but we don't know like we know other things.
What are your preferences?
That's a good question. I think you saw a lot of sort of economic societal improvements. Mm-hmm. You saw changes in sort of how we policed. Pat Sharkey, who's a sociologist at Princeton, has a wonderful book where he talks about community investment, essentially. And you can draw a causal connection between investment in sort of nonprofits that support communities and reductions, like actual reductions in people killed. I think that you can probably, I know that you can kind of point to the fact that we dramatically increased the incarceration rate, which had a ton of negative repercussions. It was a terrible idea. And we have proven that it was an unnecessary, harmful step. So I want to get that out of the way. At the same time, it does, when you incarcerate the hell out of people, it does incarcerate people. It takes them off the streets. And I don't want to suggest that I'm advocating that or in any way, but it had that effect. We hired a lot of officers, and in a lot of places we like New Orleans, where I am, 432 murders in 94, which was, for a city of 600,000, was until recently the largest one-year murder rate that any large city had recorded. And they basically came in, they brought in a new police chief. He fired everybody on the staff. They had a whole bunch of really heinous murders committed by the police department. Like people, officers that are on death row right now in Louisiana that committed murders, like straight up mob style murders. So they fired a whole bunch of crooked officers. They brought in new officers. They policed, they improved community trust. And so I think all of these things, and they improved the clearance rate of murder and
right, which is the rate at which they mark a crime solved.
Yes. And so you had all of these things. And I compare it to, like, if you gave me the best chocolate cake in the world and you said, here are the ingredients, go make it. I don't know what to do. Like, you've given me chocolate and, you know, butter and flour, and I'm going to give my ignorance of how to make a chocolate cake. But like, you put all these ingredients on the table. You can't bake the cake from that. You have to know in what order, what's the most important.
Right.
And so we don't know that, I think, is the challenge.
Well, I'm curious, so to back up a little bit, not only why did it get better after the 90s, but why did it get so bad in the first place in the 90s? The 90s specifically, like, why did the 90s implode?
It was the 80s, really. It all started in the 80s. I mean, I think it's tied to, we had this, we had this extremely harsh reaction. You had the war on drugs, you had massive increases in incarceration, massive increases in firearms that were flooding the streets. And you didn't have that community support that I think you had in the 90s and the 2000s. And if you want to talk about the 2020s, why we're seeing what we're seeing now, I think you can point to community support as a major factor in why 2020 happened and then 2023 to 2025 happened.
So are you surprised that it backed off of that, you know, that increase so quickly? I mean, quickly, I mean, 5 years isn't nothing, but, you know, it's not the full decade. You said it started, you started to see it in mid-2023. That feels pretty quick to me. I mean, is that something that you kind of weren't expecting?
Oh, entirely. I try not to have expectations as far as like what's going to happen. I think it's very difficult to say whether or not it's going to go up or down, but it wasn't until we started measuring it going down that it was obviously going down. I mean, there was no, I don't think that there was an expectation. If you'd told me in 2020 that over the next 5 years, murder stayed the same, I don't think I would have been surprised by that. So I don't think there was anybody that sort of expected America in 2026 to be where we are from where we were in 2021 or 2022.
Does some of this is going to sound weird, but stay with me. Does some of this come down to the weather? I hear some people be like, well, it wasn't that hot this summer. Is that a thing?
No. It's a good question. One of my first pieces for 538 when, rest in peace, when I was working there as a freelancer, was in looking at the weather. And what we see is that it's not a hot thing, it's a cold thing. So you could make the opposite case. If we see an increase in violence, you could say, oh, well, the summers weren't as cold. Because what happens is when it gets cold, people go indoors. And when they're indoors, they don't kill each other as much. Mm-hmm. And so the basic idea is that we don't really, if it's 90 degrees or 94 degrees or 86 degrees, that doesn't really affect shootings. What really affects shootings is when it gets really cold.
One thing I've been hearing a lot is that this must be because of this administration deporting a lot of people. Is that a factor?
I don't believe that's a factor for several reasons. One is that this started in 2023.
That would be an important caveat.
It is. And if you think about the math, so if your denominator, if your numerator stays the same, let's say we have around 3,000 fewer murder victims each year. So from, you know, 2022 to 2023, 2023 to 2024, our numerator in terms of calculating the percent change in murder stays the same, roughly, around 3,000. That's not exactly what happened, but it's more or less what happened. But our denominator keeps getting smaller. So, you know, you go from 21,000 murders as your denominator when calculating the 2023 number to 18,000 to 15,000, you're going to see a dramatic drop in your percent change without seeing, like, you're basically seeing a steady drop in murder, but the percent change keeps getting bigger because you're not seeing, you're basically comparing it to fewer and fewer to start with when you're doing your percent change. So I've described that terribly. But I think that's the first major point, is that it's not like we're seeing some dramatic acceleration in the change in murder. We've seen a very remarkably consistent drop in murder month after month for 3 straight years. The second thing is that the vast, 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 vast majority of victims in this country, and by extension, offenders, are not immigrants, and they're certainly not illegal immigrants. And yes, you can point to tragedies, and everybody can point to tragedies that involve any type of perpetrator. And you can point to horrific murders committed by people that were illegally in this country and never should have been here. And it's a tragedy that they were here. But you can't point to anecdotes as a driver. And so what is the driver of this change? That's not what's causing it. And you look at places that have had virtually no immigration enforcement, and you see dramatic drops in murder. And you look at places that have seen enormous immigration enforcement, and you can, like Chicago, you can compare the before and the after ICE went there, and you see no change in the city's violent crime trend. It was like murder was down 40% in Chicago last year before, and 40% after DHS got there.
I will be upfront about my bias in that I personally am very skeptical that any president would have that big of an impact on crime, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. I know it started under Biden's tenure. I still am, you know, and I know some Democrats like to say, well, he, you know, brought in this crime decline. And of course, the Trump administration is really leaning into the recent news. I think Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary, shared an article that was citing your data on the subject to take credit for the administration. Do you think that whoever is president really has much of an impact? Am I wrong in being skeptical of that?
No, I share your skepticism. I much prefer the White House talking about the trend and claiming credit than, which is, I think, normal. Like every politician, it's going to happen. That's fine. Even despite my skepticism, rather than what we've been seeing a lot of times, which is, you know, crime is out of control, everything's the worst, violent crime is crazy. I much prefer, you know, hey, it's down. And I want to give Kash Patel credit on this, because he's been talking about this since I've been talking about this. I think I wrote about it in April, that how we might see the largest one-year drop ever recorded to the lowest murder rate ever recorded, if you just do the math of the napkin math. And he picked it up immediately and has been talking about, hey, everything's down. If we want to talk about where my skepticism sort of melts, it's looking at the rationale for why murder fell in the first place, and why it fell so much in that 2023-2024 timeframe, and why it started. And there, I think that you can probably point to things like the Inflation Reduction Act, like the American Rescue Plan Act, that provided communities with a lot of funding to restart programs, to invest in violence interruption, to invest enormous funds in infrastructure repair and in street lighting and neighborhood social centers. And so I think that, and these were not crime fighting measures by any means, but I think you could make a very compelling case that these community investments were the driver that sort of helped to kickstart everything else and that recovery.
Other than street lamps, I mean, street lamps are an interesting topic because the idea of people don't want to commit crimes when it's well lit, which is, I think, follows from common sense. What other initiatives are you thinking from these bills? I think about the Inflation Reduction Act as something that unfortunately increased or may have increased inflation. So I've always been a little skeptical that it had the impact that it was going for. What parts of the spending package do you think could have saved some lives?
Well, so, and again, none of this was intentional. I think that you can look at the neighborhood and social centers is another one that I like to point to. People talk about juvenile curfews a lot. And the research actually tells us that when you do juvenile curfews, it leads to increasing crime because it...
They're trying one of those in DC, or they tried recently.
Yeah, because you take people off the street and that does a couple of things. One, it takes witnesses away. It makes it easier for people who already want to commit crimes to do that. And it if you and I get into a fight and no one's around and one of us...
I'm going to lose.
I don't know about that. I'm pretty weak. But like the likelihood that that turns into something deadly or something serious gets much worse if nobody's around. If you and I get into a fight in a crowded room and somebody breaks us up very quickly,
right?
Whatever, we got into a fight, we go our own ways and go to bed and sleep it off.
But we survive it.
We survive it. And so the former is essentially what happened in 2021. I think that you could make a case that enormous, like it's something like a 90% increase in state and local government spending on infrastructure between specifically related to social and neighborhood centers between 2021 and 2024. The New Orleans, again, I'm familiar with it. It's a good example. The city spent like 80% of its ARPA money just fixing, and I might be overstating it, but they spent it fixing the budget holes that came from 2020. And so when the city wanted to spend money on violence interrupters in 2022, they had the funds available because they weren't trying to fix, you know, the fact that they had this enormous drop in tourism. And so the city spent something like $2 million of its own money launching a hospital interrupter program.
Can you explain to the what really is a violence interruption program?
So in this case, they're spending money to have staff that come to every shooting and they go to the hospital. And so if you are shot, they spend staff time that and resources that goes to the hospital. They meet with you. They meet with your family. They try and work with you to basically encourage you to cooperate with police to solve, you know, whoever shot you. If you have housing problems, if you have medical issues, they help to pay for or to figure out how you're going to pay for these issues. They work with the family to essentially provide support. So that, you know, mental health support, financial support, so that your shooting does not become a retribution, does not become another shooting. And these are people that oftentimes have been involved in gun violence, are older, wiser members of the community that are able to bring a perspective that allows for your best opportunity to prevent this from becoming another shooting.
Right. So kind of in the vein of a beat cop, the idea that a cop who's a part of the neighborhood, a part of the community, is friends with people, that sort of thing. Having that relationship, obviously they're not literal law enforcement, but that used to be a really big part of policing.
Yeah. And a lot of these programs with budgetary issues, with it's hard to do that during COVID. You're in a pandemic. You can't go to a hospital and visit people because you can't go to a hospital to begin with during COVID. So a lot of these programs went away. New Orleans spent $2 million that it had in a city that doesn't have a lot of money on launching a pilot. The pilot was successful. And then they got a very large grant from DOJ to launch this citywide. So not just the hospitals, but going to neighborhoods when these things occur and working with the citizenry to make sure that shootings don't happen again.
Right.
Speaking of, I mean, you mentioned clearance rates. Police, I think people are, a lot of people are unaware. Police are very bad at solving crime. You know, some of the clearance rates out of these cities are about 50%, you know, meaning that you have like a 50-50 chance of getting away with murder, which just blows my mind. I mean, shouldn't there be more resources spent on that, on helping them prioritize solving violent crime? I mean, why are they so bad at that?
Absolutely. I'm going to quiz you. We did this. We have a Instagram channel, Real Time Crime Index, where we just did a man on the street interview where we went around asking Tulane students questions. And one of the questions is, what is the national auto theft clearance rate? And so I want you to guess what the auto theft clearance rate is nationally.
40%?
Last year it was 9%.
Oh, wow.
You
have a 91% chance of stealing a car and getting away with it?
You do.
Do not do that to the listeners. Do not do that. We are not encouraging that. That's
you were exactly like the Tulane students. I think 40% was sort of the guess that we got the most.
I'm embarrassed.
Well, the murder clearance rate is around 60% nationally. And has been hovering there for most of the last few decades. It hasn't gotten better. It hasn't gotten worse. It's absolutely something we should pour resources into. There was research in Boston where the researchers took fatal and non-fatal shootings, and they compared the solve rate for both of those. And so looking at the fatal shootings over time, in the first 48 hours, the solve rate was no different in the first 48 hours compared to the non-fatal shootings. And afterwards, fatal shootings, they solved a lot more of those than the non-fatal shootings. And what happened was the non-fatal shootings, the detectives worked the same amount the first 2 days, and then they worked other shootings. They had more non-fatal shootings. They had robberies. They weren't a dedicated non-fatal shooting unit. They were a violent crime unit. And the homicide unit, though, was just looking at homicides. And so what this shows is that it's a choice to solve murders at a higher rate than other crimes. In Phoenix, there was this research in the early 2000s where they looked at every single homicide. And what they found was that they put the homicides into four different categories. They had the unsolved ones, which was, again, like 50% of them. They had the immediate ones, where they walked in on me and I was holding a bloody knife and your body was on the ground with stab wounds. Okay, they solved that, but they didn't need to do anything.
Right.
The third version was the ones that they solved quickly. These were the fast ones that were solved like within a week. And then the others were the whodunits that were solved with a longer time frame. And so if you compare the quick ones within a week with the whodunits that they solved within a month, 2 months, 3 months, the only difference between them was that the quick ones had more detectives. They had more patrol officers on the scene gathering evidence. They gathered more evidence. They found more witnesses. And those are the things that led to them solving them quicker. And so there's lots of evidence that it's a choice in terms of the amount of resources that you put into it. Yet we absolutely should be solving more crimes. If you solve a murder, it gets a murderer off the streets. And we know that far more than the length of a sentence, the greatest deterrent effect that we can have from a policing and a criminal justice standpoint is in terms of the swiftness and the certainty of getting caught. And that is, if you thought that there was a 90% chance that you were going to get caught stealing a car, you wouldn't steal a car. But you know that it's 9%. You may not know that it's exactly 9%. Right. But you know intuitively that it's really good odds that you're not going to get caught, and so you go and do it.
There seems to be quite a delta between what you're saying and, I mean, you alluded to this earlier, how people feel. I was recently traveling. I go to Paris twice a year, and every person when I got back, not every person, but probably like four or five people asked me, but did you feel safe? I mean, obviously Paris isn't in the States, but it's like it's at the front of everyone's mind. The idea that if you go to a major metropolitan area, you are perhaps unsafe. How do you respond to people who do not, you know, who say, well, the crime is going down, but I don't feel safe. I don't feel safe in the US. I don't feel safe abroad. I don't feel safe.
I mean, cities have crime. They've had crime ever since we sort of organized ourselves into cities, I imagine, as a species. So, and also it's not linear. Cities with larger populations have sort of, to an exponential degree, more crime. And so it's something that, like, you're never going to feel 100% safe. In general, I think people's perceptions of safety tend not to follow reality. And so for me, the question is not to say, hey, it's everything's great, everything's hunky-dory, sort of F your feelings or something like that. I see my role, and it's why I write the newsletter. It's why I have a podcast that came out. We're doing this Instagram channel. We've got a YouTube channel related to the Real-Time Crime Index. I'm just pitching everything right now because this is a perception issue. And the podcast is all about, how do we better perceive this? How do we convince people that the reality is the reality, which is not inherently to tell them that it's all, they're always wrong, but it's to make people less reliant on anecdote, where your anecdote is always going to make you think everything's right. Worse.
Like the slashiest terrible. Story ever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I saw in the news that there was a robbery, so things must be terrible.
Right. Speaking of, is there something when you're looking through the media coverage of this where you're like, a specific mistake that is consistently made that makes you, like, you know, do a full body eye roll? Or
no? Well, I guess a couple of things. One is it's January and people sometimes will do like, hey, murder's down 30%. Nothing. You really need a month that ends in R before you start to evaluate like your annual trend from a citywide perspective. Or you'll see the police department will come out and say, hey, shootings were down 28% this month compared to this month last year. It's like, well, that's not useful because you didn't go in front of the press last year when shootings were up 8%. So those things getting covered, I think, bother me.
The way I just went through every month in my head until I got one that ended in an R. Okay. Okay. So covering things too early.
September.
Yeah, I got there eventually.
So I think those things tend to annoy me. I think that people that, and again, we had the confidence of the discussion about like causes. And I think that usually crime is the ultimate failure as an orphan, success has many parents issue. When crime is down, you'll see every single politician and political agency in the city and in the state, in the county, they're all going out and saying, hey, this is, you know, we launched this program.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And when crime is up, not a single one of them will ever be seen in an article. And I kept this article from July 2022. New Orleans in June 2022 had the most murders of any month since before Hurricane Katrina. And it's like just terrible, tragic, and traumatic. And the article interviewed the newspaper. It was noting this fact, and it interviewed the police department in the newspaper. And the police department response was that they can't be responsible for policing interpersonal conflict. It was like, you know, as soon as murder's down, they're going to talk about how they're successfully policing interpersonal conflict. But it was like, that's your job, is to police interpersonal conflict. And right. So,
do you see, big disparities between, you know, we hear a lot about blue cities versus, you know, red cities more in the South. Is there a big disparity there? And if so, what does it look like?
It's the exact same. And I actually did this. It didn't make a piece, but I did this look. I took the top 100 cities in 2025 by population and divided them up by mayor. And I think I got data from 98 of the cities, and murder in the Democrat cities were down 20%, and murder in the Republican cities were down 20%. Right. And the sort of,
and for the audience, there are Republican cities that are usually smaller. I mean, people are like, there are only Democratic cities. I mean, there are Republican cities.
The major cities are almost all Democrat. It used to be Jacksonville, I think, was the one that had a Republican mayor. But even then, but like, even the mayors, like some cities have strong mayors, some cities have weak mayors, some cities have strong city council and city managers, and some cities have. So It depends. And these are usually big societal things, and who the political party of the mayor is usually totally
right.
Totally doesn't matter. I tweeted this in 2020 about how murder was rising in red cities and blue cities, and it actually made it into the debate between Trump and Biden.
Oh, wow.
No credit, of course, but it was a pet peeve in 2020, and it's a pet peeve now that we don't see any difference there.
I know we're running out of time, but I do want to learn a little more about you. So you said you're in New Orleans. How did you get into this, like, very in the weeds crime reporting? What drew you to that?
That's an excellent question. So I was born and raised in New Orleans,
which is an amazing city.
It's a great city. And went to the University of Texas for my undergrad, moved to DC for grad school. I was in DC for 7 years. I worked for Defense Department for a year and CIA for 5 years. I got my I wanted to serve, and I got the service bug out of me. I got my 20s out of me and met my now wife in DC. We got married and we're like, okay, let's get closer to family. And so we moved back to New Orleans. And I had a skill set. You know, you're in DC, everybody's got advanced degrees. They've got master's degrees. There's think tanks. There's lots of places you make a living just sort of thinking about things, and New Orleans does not think about things. And, it's a very much a, like, you know, let's go with the vibes of it city. And, which is great for like partying and jazz, but not great for sort of structured government. And, so I ended up working with the city, for about 2 years as the first crime analyst that they'd had in decades. And they hired me as a crime analyst and no idea what to do with me, and sort of stuck me in something of a closet. And I did some research and got familiar with the subject matter, but aside from that, didn't really do much. And so I started consulting, and I'd worked for the city of New Orleans and for the CIA. And so nobody knew who I was. And part of it was that, okay, I'm just going to start writing. And so I started a local blog and got connected with 538 and just started writing about it. And it felt like a subject matter that nobody was writing about. There's academics doing really excellent work, and there's people working for police departments doing analysis of this, but it didn't feel like there was anybody trying to communicate what the data showed to a wide audience. And so that's sort of,
and this might sound like a stupid question, but why do you think it's important that people know the data?
Because otherwise we're driven by fear and anecdote. And I think it's weird that you think to ask that. And that's not a weird question, because I get that a lot. But like, why do we care about who won the Super Bowl, or like, you know, who won the football games last weekend, or who won the each baseball, or whether a batter gets a hit, or whether or not, how many jobs the US government added? Like, how do you do anything policy wise or running a sports team or anything in society without collecting and understanding data? And there's really no other subject matter that I can think of that is so driven by anecdote, and the policies are not driven by research and data and science as much as with crime and criminal justice. And so it's crazy to think about, why wouldn't we want better data and understanding?
Oh, I agree. What was it like working at the CIA?
I miss it from a working standpoint, that I'll never get that level of sort of intellectual rigor, I think, as much. I don't want to insult my current subject matter. But like, to know things that nobody else in the country knew, that was just like, you know, I guess from an ego standpoint and from a intellectual interest standpoint, you just sort of, I thought was the best thing that I'll ever get. I loved that I would go to parties, like, you know, back before I had kids and I could actually socialize, and I'd like be with my college friends and I'll be like, none of these people are doing anything as interesting as me. I enjoyed that. But from a, like a psychological, hey, I don't have to lie every day. And I love DC. I lived in Navy Yard before it was like, when it was a hole in the ground.
Oh, right. That was before it was cute.
Yeah. It It was I moved there right after the ballpark went in. When like they did all of the construction, they tore everything down and all the gentrification, and they started building these buildings, but they then all ran out of funding because of the collapse of the economy. And so I lived two blocks from the stadium. I went to baseball constantly. It was amazing. I met my wife. We would walk to the Capitol. But then I was like, oh, I could, you know, I sold my condo and the real estate in New Orleans is just like so much cheaper. And I could buy a house where we can raise kids for a one bedroom condo. So
a couple of my closest friends live in New Orleans. So I've spent quite a bit of time there. Are you a Mardi Gras man?
I love Mardi Gras because of how it, one, I loved it as a kid. People don't realize the degree to which it is a nightly festival for children.
Oh my gosh, so many things thrown at you, so many fun socks and candy, and it really is. It's perfect for kids. It's so fun.
It is, and we set up my son's grade has a house, like somebody owns that house across the street, and so we all pitch in and we set up these step stools and. You know, people bring food and you go out there and you're out all day and you just sort of stand there and drink a beer and your kids have fun and they explore and like, it's so different. And they hear the best music in the world and they see, these like beautiful floats and catch crap that then goes into the attic and will eventually give away. And it's beautiful.
So let's end here. I know that you said you hate when people analyze at the beginning of the year. But I'm going to ask you this question anyway. And it is, are you hopeful for 2026?
Call me a pessimist.
Oh, no.
I do not think the United States is going to reach zero murders. So at some point, we will not continue to see 3,000 fewer murders each year. Sure. Because if we do that, then by 2030, we'll have zero murders. So my assumption is that we will probably see a smaller change this year than we saw last year. So kind of this, I think that what we'll see will be probably a couple of percentage points, a much more normal drop in murder. We'll probably set a new record again in terms of the lowest murder rate ever recorded, just because we're going to see fewer murders. But that sort of this historic drop in crime has probably ended. We might see it continue to drop in property crime and violent crime overall, which have all, you know, we didn't even talk about those, but those have also seen tremendous drops over the last few years. But that we're probably going to see more of a leveling off, just because as an analyst, you don't expect historic changes. You expect the baseline. And so the baseline suggests that it'll be closer to normal.
Jeff Ashrow, thank you for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.